Good morning. I'm State Senator Connie Johnson, retired, Chair of the Oklahoma Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And I'm pleased to welcome you and to thank you for being with us today for the fourth press conference related to the innocence that we strongly believe Richard Glossop has. Today we're going to hear yet another update on the status of the legal defense team's work that is working pro bono, that is being led by Don Knight. He will give us remarks and updates. We're still working hard. There are a couple of activities planned both today and tomorrow, and Wednesday, of course, we'll have the vigil in front of the governor's office. But on tomorrow, we invite you to join us at the Statute of the Ten Commandments, where we will be holding another press conference just as a witnessing moment for members of the coalition, advocates, and other believers. So we're asking everyone who wants to please join us at the Ten Commandments statue on the northeast corner of the Capitol. At this point, I would like to bring to you Richard Glossop's legal defense team lead attorney, Mr. Don Knight, who has done considerable work at the federal level on death penalty cases and has been successful in achieving some significant rulings on behalf of people who have been on death row. Mr. Knight.
Thanks for that introduction, and thank you all for being here. There's a lot of people here, and I think that shows how really important this matter is for the state of Oklahoma, and really for this country as a whole. The death penalty is really under scrutiny right now, as well it should be. But this case really brings a kind of central point to it. This man is innocent. We've done a lot of work in order to make that determination, but he is. I want to start by telling you a little bit about the press conference. We do have Barry Scheck on the telephone right now. He is listening to what's going on, and he will be speaking in a little bit. At least we're going to try to make that work on the phone. Afterwards, I know some of you may also have questions for Sister Helen Prejean. She is here. She'll speak a little at the end of this as well. Barry Scheck recently authored an open letter that went into the Huffington Post asking the governor for a 60-day stay on this execution. That letter was co-signed by former Senator Tom Coburn, former head football coach Barry Switzer, former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Oklahoma, John Raley, and as I said, Barry Scheck, and also Samuel Gross, a professor of law at the University of Michigan and editor of the National Registry of Exonerations. These people work with exonerations. They know what it's like to have people who are convicted of crimes, some of them are sentenced to death, and then to later find out that the evidence that was used to convict them was not sufficient in one way or another. And sometimes that just has to do with bad testimony. So he'll speak on that a little bit. The last time I stood before you in July, I began by saying, we have to start this press conference with mentioning the family of Barry Van Treese. Their pain, and their recurring pain because of everything that's happening now, is real. And we have to respect that. There was a letter that was written this week by a woman whose name is Christy Shepherd. She's someone who has suffered from having a family member murdered. And she wrote, to begin this letter, "National attention is focused on the pending execution of Richard Glossop and on his potential innocence. As a murder victim's family member, it has always bothered me that the victim and family seemed to be a side note. Barry Van Treese, the victim in Glossop's case, was a victim of an awful crime. My heart and that of my family aches for his family. I don't think that Barry Van Treese should be a side note here. When I spoke to you in July, I didn't know a lot about the case. I knew some things about the case, but I didn't know a lot about the case. I told you that what I had learned then had given me some pause for concern that Richard Glossop might be an innocent man. We have done a lot of work. I am not, as introduced, lead counsel in this case. I'm one of three lawyers, Kathleen Lord and Mark Olive being the other two, who are giving our time, and it's equal time, and it's a lot of time, to this case. And we have been working very, very hard with the help of other people as well, such as Barry Scheck and people like that. We've hired investigators to go out and do the hard work that should have been done, but we've gotten some work done, but there's a lot more to do. If we had 60 more days, we could get a lot more done. I'll give you an example of that. I was home back in Colorado on Sunday morning, and it was 1:47 a.m., and someone called my cell phone. And it was a man who said he was in the Best Budget Inn back in January, or I'm sorry, not in January, but in the months leading up to January 1997. And he just had to say something about what he saw there. What he saw at that time was simply that he thought Richard was a good guy. That's all he wanted to tell me. Richard was a good guy. He didn't really have any information that was helpful to me, but I had never heard of this man before or seen this man before. Because of the publicity that we've generated, he came forward because he thought, maybe I can help. Maybe I have something to say that can help this situation out. That's the kind of thing that's been happening in this case ever since I've gotten involved, and really ever since the last time we met. Because of the press conference we had then, and because of Sister Helen's work with Susan Sarandon, getting us onto Dr. Phil, we've had a lot of people come out and start making telephone calls and give us information, and I'll share some of that with you today. When this case was tried, the defense lawyers did almost no investigation. I know that now because we've had our investigators out looking and talking to people. And I'll give you an example. One of the three key witnesses in this case is Deanna Wood. Deanna Wood was at the Best Budget Inn throughout all of this period of time, was Richard Glossop's girlfriend. We interviewed her. She said she might have seen a defense investigator, but it was a very short conversation. And we did see one report, and it's a two-paragraph report, and all it does is give identifying information. No questions were asked at all of her about what happened. So we know, with witness after witness that we've seen, that there's been no real investigation done in this case. So when this case went to trial, the prosecution was ready. The prosecution was really ready. They had this case investigated, and they had it looking exactly how they wanted it to look. Excuse me. And how it looked to them at that time was that Justin Sneed had somehow stumbled into the Best Budget Inn. He was kind of a a dupe almost. I reviewed Mr. Ackley's statements from his closing argument, and this is what he had to say about Justin Snead at that time. This is from page 67 and 68 of the transcript of June 1st of 2004. He said to the jury, "Do you think for one minute that this young man, who found a better way to keep body and soul together than climbing on roofs in Oklahoma in July, satisfied and contented with that humble life, do you really think he did this alone? What did he stand to gain besides money, which he didn't get by killing Barry Van Treese? I suggest to you that only one conclusion lies, and that is that he didn't do it alone, that he had help." Once again, that sort of, here he is, staying at the best budget, a humble guy, not wanting much. He went on further to say at page 92 that Justin Snead left the motel on January 7th, 1997 because Richard told him to. "Under the facts," Mr. Ackley said, "is there any reason, any other reason, why a guy that was content to play a little Nintendo, clean a few rooms, stay down off 105-degree roofs in Oklahoma, not paid much, not putting out much effort, kind of a casual, take-it-as-it-comes kind of life that a 19-year-old might see some merit in?" So once again, they're painting him as this guy who's got a, not a great life, but a good enough life. A good enough life there at the Best Budget Inn. Ms. Smotherman closed by stating, she's another one of the prosecutors, "Why would Snead do this himself? I mean, why? He's got an okay life. The only possible reason that they can even suggest to you that he would even do it by himself is because, well, you know, he's a druggie. He was getting it. He was bumming it off people. He didn't use it that often, but he kind of liked it when it was there. Why would he need to? Why would he need that much money?" So that's the picture the jury got of Justin Snead from the prosecution, from their closing argument. When I started on this case, I couldn't put my finger on it, but there were some things that just didn't seem right. First off, Justin Snead had said that he left Texas. He loves his girls, and I have no doubt, they were little children at that time. He loved his girls, but he left Texas, and he said he left Texas so he could make money so they could have a better life. So he joined the roofing crew, the Brassfield roofing crew. And he went to Oklahoma City, and he was making $500 a week with the Brassfield roofing crew. Sure, it's hard work, but he was making a lot of money, and that's what he needed. He needed money so that he could take care of his girls. And yet, somehow or another, he stops working, and he goes to the Best Budget Inn, where, admittedly, he's making no money. That kind of rang kind of strange to me. Why would someone do that? Why would someone quit a job that they took for the sole purpose of making money just to stop? You might do that if you found someone to love, maybe. Maybe love could do that to you. Or maybe something else. Maybe something else. Detectives Bimo and Cook, when they were interviewing him, it always struck me as strange. I said, "Geez, you're awfully thin. You know, don't you get any food when you're there?" "Well, you know, I get a little bit from Richard every now and again." "Well, how do you do that? That doesn't seem okay. How do you do that?" Kayla Pursley testified that she had to make him eat. That doesn't sound like a 19-year-old man to me. Again, these little telltale signs that just kind of rubbed me wrong and made me wonder, what's really going on? And of course, the real big problems that I had with the narrative that Richard Glossop wanted to kill Barry Van Treese for the money just never made any sense. I've said to many of you in this room, and I'll say it as many times as I need to, I've represented criminal defendants for 33 years, and I've never known one who would walk away from $4,000 in order to kill somebody for two. The man had $4,000 in his hand, gave it to Barry Van Treese, and the prosecution wanted everybody to believe that what he did next was tell Justin Sneed to go kill him and give me $2,000 back. Who would do that? The other part of the prosecution's theory was, well, he did it because he was going to be fired. Well, he had jobs before. He could have got another job. Or another one was, well, he did it because he was going to take over the motel. Somehow or another, you could kill the owner and you could get the motel. I don't know how that would have worked, but that was the theory the prosecution used. I told you back in July that we had a long list of witnesses that we wanted to see. One of those witnesses that we wanted to see was a man named Richard Barrett. I've sent out the affidavit of Richard Barrett. You all have it. Richard Barrett was one of the people that I had mentioned, kind of called out in the last press conference and said there were some unsavory characters there at the Best Budget Inn. Richard Barrett was one of those. So last week, I took an investigator. We found Mr. Barrett, actually. We found him. It wasn't the easiest thing in the world to do, but we found him. And we sat down for an interview with Mr. Barrett. Mr. Barrett turns out to be the missing link. He is the one who makes it all work in a much different narrative, a narrative that actually holds together than the prosecution gives you. Mr. Barrett says he used to sell methamphetamine. He used to sell methamphetamine with Bobby Glossop. And he said in the fall of 1996, he ended up going to the Best Budget Inn where Bobby Glossop was, where he would deliver methamphetamine to Bobby for the purposes of sale there. First time he went there, he said there was a young man identified as the maintenance man in the room shooting up methamphetamine with a needle. Bobby Glossop said, "Be careful. Be careful of your car. Make sure it's locked. That's the maintenance man here. And that guy will break into your car. He'll steal stuff from your car." Richard Barrett remembered that. Richard Barrett said approximately three or four times a week he would go to the Best Budget Inn. Usually get there at 11 o'clock at night, stay till about 3 or 4 in the morning, where he'd deliver methamphetamine. And every single time, within 10 to 30 minutes, this maintenance man, who is now identified as Justin Sneed, would come to the room to buy methamphetamine. And he would sometimes use a needle in front of them, but he was definitely an intravenous user of methamphetamine. What was also interesting in talking to Mr. Barrett, who, by the way, doesn't benefit at all from his testimony here. When I first talked to Mr. Barrett, I didn't, his cousin called him. He was in prison, he's out now, but he's still on court-ordered supervision. And when we first called him and told him what we needed, he was on the phone to his cousin hung up the phone. He hung up the phone on his cousin, on his own cousin. She tried to call him back. He wouldn't take her call. We were about ready to leave, and his mother drives up. And his mother says, "You know, what's going on?" And we tell her what's going on. And she says, "I know about that case. I've seen it in the news. I really feel bad for that Mr. Glossop. He's an innocent man. We can't let this happen. Does Mr. Barrett know something about this? Does Richard Barrett know something? We said, well, we think he does. He was there. So she got back on the phone with him, and she said, can you come? And he said, okay, all right, I'll come and I'll meet. And we sat down and we talked to Mr. Barrett. So this is a man who doesn't want to come forward. He's got a good job with a good company. He doesn't want his name out in the news, but he has said, I'll do this. I'll do this because my mother asked me to, and I'll do this because it's the right thing to do. So he told us about seeing Justin Snead and seeing Justin Snead shoot methamphetamine into his veins. And he also told us each time the maintenance man would come to room 102, he would use cash, mostly coins or items, to trade for methamphetamine. I specifically recall Justin Snead bringing the following items to trade for drugs. Food stamps, and he remembered. He said he would trade $150 in stamps for $100 in drugs. Radar detectors, car stereos, the kind of things you get out of cars. A Samsonite silver hardcover briefcase, which he remembered very well because he said he ended up with that. And he said on one occasion, he saw Mr. Snead bring in a nickel-plated 38 caliber handgun. He said he was present when Snead told Bobby Glossop, that he had taken these items from occupied rooms at the motel and cars in the parking lot. He said he specifically remembered that day because he didn't see guns come in that often. But he said on that day, Bobby traded a 16, he said, which I think is a 16th of an ounce of methamphetamine, for that gun. Mr. Barrett furthermore told us Mr. Barrett had a methamphetamine problem as well, but he didn't shoot the methamphetamine. He snorted it. We'll talk about that in a minute. But he said that the effects of the drugs would last for days. He observed Justin Snead shoot up with a needle. In his opinion, because of the amount of drugs Justin Snead bought and what he saw, there was no doubt in his mind that Justin Snead was addicted to methamphetamine. He told us that people with this addiction stay awake for days or weeks and will do anything to get more of the drug, even kill. People get very paranoid and mean when they're high on methamphetamine, and he said they'll shoot someone or even beat someone to death if it keeps other people from telling about the fact that they're using drugs. So now we know. We know that Justin Snead wasn't some poor waif, some innocent little guy who just didn't want to be on the roofs at 105 degrees, making money for his daughters. We now know, because we found Richard Barrett, we now know he was just a drug addict. He found something that he liked better, sadly, than even his family, and that was drugs. And that's what he was doing there at the Best Budget Inn. And why didn't he need to eat? Because people on methamphetamine don't eat. Richard Barrett told us, I was standing in front of a man who weighed 170 pounds. He said, when I was doing meth, I weighed 110. People who are on methamphetamine don't eat. What did Bimo and Cook say? Well, gee, you're awfully thin. Doesn't he feed you over there? Maybe a little bit now and again, if he can beg it off of somebody. We know that it wasn't, as Miss Motherman said to the jury in her closing, that he would use it occasionally, sometimes, when he could pick it up. He was picking it up all right. He was picking it up by going to occupied rooms, using his pass key as the maintenance man at the motel to steal goods, or going into parked cars and stealing things from those parked cars. And that's what he was doing. Mr. Barrett was not available to the defense. Even if those lawyers could have found him, they would not have. His name was out there. The first lawyer, Wayne Fawnerod, actually had a letter, and that's the only way we know, because there was a letter to him while he was in prison saying, come to trial. Not the optimal way to do it. Usually you interview someone first, but that's how Mr. Fawnerod decided to do it. Mr. Barrett said, I wasn't going to cooperate, and I would not have cooperated. And he says, I got rid of that letter, and I've been in prison, and I've been out of prison, and I haven't tried to reach out, and nobody's tried to reach out to me. Until we came along. So now we know a little bit more about what happened at the Best Budget Inn on January 7th of 1997 in the early morning hours. Now we know that somebody who has a history of breaking into rooms using his pass key did it again. We also know that Justin Snead has been just all over the place in telling us about his drug use. Many of you have seen the stories, Eight is Enough, that I've prepared and given out. We're giving out another document today. It's another summary. This summary helps us understand things a little bit more question by question. And so when we go to the part that says Snead and drugs, we can see that he says, I did drugs, crank and methamphetamine that's cooked days before, but not during the time I killed Barry. He says, I snorted it. He says, I don't know why I quit work. I got entangled with a little bit of drugs and stuff. I lost sight of my goals and purpose. He says, I took marijuana and crank. I was using drugs twice a week, depending on if I ran into somebody willing to share. He says, I spent money I made from roofing on crank and marijuana. Then he says to the jury, in trial number two, I paid for drugs with money I hustled up. I guess they didn't push him very hard on that. He also told trial number two, jury, the last time I took drugs was before Christmas of 1996, which of course he had previously said he did it just days before. And we've seen other documents where he actually admitted he was coming down off of a methamphetamine high at the time that he broke into the Barry Van Treese's room 102. Once we had this information, and one more piece of information, we went out and we interviewed his mother as well. And you're going to see her affidavit inside the packet that you're all going to get. By the way, we're going to go on ahead and send a packet out to everyone whose email we have. If I don't have your email, if you haven't ever received an email from me, make sure we get it, and we'll go ahead and get that out to you. How do we know further that he was hooked on drugs, that he had a problem? His own mother told our investigator, Justin was really heavy into drugs at the time of the murder in 1997. So the narrative the prosecution presented falls apart. There's nothing to it anymore. What do we have here? I reached out to a forensic psychiatrist, an expert in many cases. His name is Pablo Stewart. He's a psychiatrist in San Francisco, California. A lot of experience in substance abuse. Dr. Stewart has prepared an affidavit to talk about what it's like to be on methamphetamine. What is that like? He said in the late 90s, the time frame involved in this affidavit that he read Mr. Barrett's affidavit, the drug was much more potent than it is today. He said methamphetamine, especially when used intravenously, over an extended period of time of weeks or months, will result in psychotic symptoms in the user. These effects are consistent with the symptoms suffered by someone in a psychotic state. and are much more likely to occur in someone who uses the drug intravenously as opposed to taking the drugs by other means, such as snorting it. These symptoms include, he said, but are not limited to, auditory and visual hallucinations, paranoid delusions, a fear that is not based in any fact, that some other person is going to cause the user extreme harm, that could include the user being killed, delusional thinking, and something that Dr. Stewart called ideas of reference. I didn't know what that meant either. He said this is an unfounded feeling that unrelated actions or movements have direct implications to the user. For example, a person addicted to methamphetamine might interpret a turn signal on a car as a sign that they are being watched by government agents. Dr. Stewart furthermore said, once the drug actually leaves the user's system, the psychotic symptoms described above remain for weeks or even months after use, even when the user is no longer intoxicated. During periods of intoxication, the user suffers from extreme agitation, rapid cycling of thoughts, and significantly impaired executive functioning. Use of the drug further erodes the user's ability to accurately assess the situation that he is in. Dr. Stewart went on to say, intravenous drug users of methamphetamine are prone to frenzied actions that can lead to overkill behaviors. In other words, the psychotic symptoms and paranoia lead intravenous users of methamphetamine to take actions far in excess of what may be needed under any given circumstance. For instance, and apropos to the allegations made in this homicide of Barry Van Treese, a person under the influence of methamphetamine or suffering from psychotic symptoms caused by long-term use will use a baseball bat and beat a victim to death in a frenzy, even if the intent is just to knock the person out with one blow. Dr. Stewart finally says, methamphetamine addiction is extremely difficult to break. Those addicted to methamphetamine will place the need for the drug over all other concerns, including family, as we talked about, food, as we talked about, safety, and obedience to the law. So what's the story here? It's not hard. It's not hard. And it's one that happens every day. Justin Snead was a drug addict. Justin Snead was a drug addict. He wasn't truthful about what he was. He wasn't truthful about his drug use, but he was a drug addict. And what did he do? He saw Barry Van Treese's car pull up in that parking lot at 3 in the morning. Deanna Wood did not come and tell him that. Or Deanna Wood didn't tell Richard that, so Richard could come to tell him that. He was up all night. This is the conduct of a person who's addicted to methamphetamine. His executive functioning is shut down. He has paranoid and delusional thoughts. He's not thinking clearly. He thinks, I know Barry Van Treese has money. I know he does. He's already been here. He picked up the money from Richard. He knows it. It's a man who's skilled at going into people's rooms. He's told us in story number 3 that he went into that room with the intention of taking the keys. He said Barry woke up, but he was going to take those keys and he was going to go in the car and he was going to get the money. How did he know the money was in the car? You might remember in story number 2, he mentioned about his brother and about how his brother talked to Richard about faking a robbery. Undoubtedly, they talked about money. But Richard said, I didn't want any part of that. I didn't have anything to do with that. Little did Richard know that Justin Snead kept that in the back of his mind, knowing I'll use that someday. So when he sees Barry pull in, he takes his key and he goes into Barry's room and he tells us what happens in there. And he says, you know, Barry got up and he came at me and I hit him once in the head. He says, I only meant to knock him out. But something went wrong. Things got out of control. That's what he said. Things got out of control. There was a witness next door, John Pretty. John Pretty heard some things. John Pretty said he heard two people arguing loud. One of them he thought might even be a woman. At least two people. He said it could have been more. Then he heard a terrible fight. Remember, Justin Snead, he never said anything at all about any voices. He said, when I went in that room, Barry said nothing. And he beat him to death without Barry saying one thing. Perhaps a sign that someone is not perceiving the events as they're actually happening. That's what happens when you're on methamphetamine. John Pretty says, things got kind of crazy. A window broke. I looked out my window to make sure my car was okay. He said, and then it quieted down for a minute or two. Then it started again. Heard the voices. I heard the aluminum hitting something. And then it got real quiet. Justin Snead broke into that room with that key, intending to get the keys to the car so that he could get the car, open it. Smash and dash wasn't his way. Smash and dash was not his way. He was not going to take his baseball bat and smash that window out. Too many people could see, too difficult to do. He thought he could get away with that. Just give me the keys and I'll take care of it. That's that delusional thinking. So Justin Snead finds himself in that motel room. Barry is putting up a fierce fight. Justin Snead goes into a frenzy. Justin Snead beats Barry Van Treese to death because of the methamphetamine. That's what happened. Afterwards, of course, it's a mess. It's a mess. The prosecution wanted you to believe that somehow or another that mess was planned and they were going to clean it up. That mess was the result of someone who was on methamphetamine, who didn't have any planning, who didn't think this was going to happen. I go back to that closing argument from the prosecution. Mr. Ackley says to the jury, Mr. Snead tried to stab someone with a blunt knife. Well, that's somebody, he was making that out to be something that a person who wasn't very smart would do. Actually, that's something that someone on methamphetamine would do. He said he left in the car a soda glass with his fingerprints all over it. That's not a sign of a person who's not very smart. It's a sign of a person who's on methamphetamine. He said he left the car in the credit union parking lot, which he did, parked in a funny way with a tire up on a curb. Something somebody who was addicted to methamphetamine would probably do. So all the things that the prosecution at trial tried to paint as being just Justin Snead, not a very smart guy, are actually things that somebody who was addicted to methamphetamine would do under those circumstances. Mr. Ackley also said to the jury, you deserve to know whether science can add anything to the testimonies of eyewitnesses to help you decide the case. I kind of chuckled a little bit because I hadn't seen this before I wrote the 8 stories document. Mr. Ackley was struck by the fact that he said Mr. Glossop had 4 stories and that was somehow a sign that he was lying. We know now that Mr. Snead had 8. I don't know if that makes him twice the liar that Mr. Ackley would say, but that's what the transcript said. In that closing argument, and I just want to take a brief aside to say, there was also some talk about how long Barry Van Treese could have lived. Phil Cross, one of your reporters, had brought that out. Mr. Ackley said, evidence between the time Mr. Pretty heard his ruckus and Dr. Choi saw the body was present that Barry Van Treese could have been revived. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Science. We put this document, this 8 stories document. In fact, the whole transcripts. We didn't just do the 8 stories document. We had the whole transcripts. The video of Justin Sneed's testimony and everything. To Richard Leo, a nationally recognized expert in false confessions. How do police get people to make false confessions? Dr. Leo took a look at this. Dr. Leo saw the telltale signs here of police involvement that produces false confessions. He said, in Mr. Glossop's case, my review of the materials leads me to conclude that the interrogating officers, Bimo and Cook, used interrogation techniques that could have elicited false and unreliable statements from Justin Sneed about Richard Glossop's alleged involvement in the homicide of Barry Van Treese. These include a presumption of guilt and investigative bias by the officers. We all know from the 8 stories document that that's exactly what they had. False evidence ploys. Remember the lies that they told him about how many people knew that he had done this? How many people were going to testify? He called minimization and maximization techniques. He said interrogation techniques and strategies that maximize the legal seriousness of the crime, such as a suggestion that the suspect will face a bad or perhaps the worst possible outcome if he or she does not make or agree to an incriminating statement. Also, the police used leading questions and scripting, multiple inconsistent and contradictory accounts by Mr. Sneed afterwards, pretty much make it conclusive that what he was giving, the information he was giving, was simply not true. We also have an affidavit in the packet you'll see from a nationally recognized polygrapher, because there was a polygraph given, and much was made of that at the competency evaluation. This Dr. Hontz, H-O-N-T-S, said he could not even determine if the polygraph was good because the charts aren't available. We tried to find those charts and give them to him. We couldn't. But Dr. Hontz also said some police departments use the polygraph primarily as an evidence ploy in their interrogations. In such cases, the accuracy of the polygraph can be very low for the actually innocent subjects, with approximately half of them producing deceptive outcomes. Such interrogation-oriented polygraph examinations have also been associated with a number of false confessions. There was no false confession by Richard here. Richard always has maintained his innocence. But it was that ploy that Bimo and Cook were using. They had Richard Glossop. They took him to see this polygrapher. He only spent about 5 minutes with the polygrapher. That's woefully inadequate. Woefully inadequate. So now we know. Now we know what happened inside that room. And we know that Richard Glossop didn't have anything to do with that. Again, we've already told you about the mistakes he made afterwards. And for that, if the police wanted to charge him or the prosecution did, they should have charged him for the mistakes he made afterwards. But did he control this? Did he put this together? All the evidence points otherwise. Because of this case, because of Sister Helen and Susan Sarandon, I got a call to go on Dr. Phil's show, and I went on that show. And after that took place, I got a telephone call from a guy. His name was Michael. Michael said, I have some information. I just want you to know. I just have some information and I just feel bad about this. This is Michael Scott. Michael Scott is another one like Richard Barrett, an incredibly brave man because he's coming forward. He doesn't want his name in the public. He doesn't want anybody to know who he is. He has signed an affidavit. You'll see the affidavit in your packet that you'll receive. But even this morning, he was like, Don, I'm not ready for that. I don't want everybody to know who I am. I get that, Michael. He's another one of those brave people coming forward just because he believes Mr. Glossop is innocent. How would he know? Who is he? He was an ex-con. He was in the Oklahoma Department of Corrections. He did a period of time for a robbery. Part of that period of time, was at the Joseph Harp Correctional Facility. And who was there but Justin Sneed? Mr. Scott said, "I got to tell you what I heard." And this is what he heard. "While at Joseph Harp, my cell was across from Justin Sneed's cell. My cellmate at the time was Mr. Plank. I recall that Mr. Sneed's cellmate was named Daryl. While I was housed near Mr. Sneed, and on more than one occasion, I heard Justin Sneed talk about the murder case that he was imprisoned for and about Richard Glossop. I clearly heard Justin Sneed say, in his statements and testimony, he set Richard up and that Richard Glossop didn't do anything. Among all the inmates," he says, "it was common knowledge that Justin Sneed lied and sold Richard Glossop up the river." He said, "As a specific example, within the first month or two of my arrival at Joseph Harp, I learned that Justin Sneed had snitched on a guy who didn't do anything. I specifically remember Justin on the top rung with a couple of other inmates fixing some food and laughing with them about setting Richard Glossop up for a crime Richard Glossop didn't do. It was almost like Justin was bragging about what he had done to this other guy, to Richard Glossop. Justin was happy and proud of himself for selling Richard Glossop out. I know Justin made up stuff to try to save his own life and get a better deal. A life sentence on a soft yard. I heard Justin talking about the deal he made and what he did to Richard. When I heard Justin Sneed say these things, I did not tell anyone. Honestly, there seemed to be many other things that I saw or heard that were much worse. And we who have not been to prison have no idea. However, when I saw the Dr. Phil show about Justin Sneed and about Mr. Glossop being executed, I knew I had to say something because I realized just how important this information was. So I called Don Knight's office since I saw him on Dr. Phil." So now we know that Justin Sneed started out way back when at the Best Budget Inn, stopped there with his roofing crew, stayed for the methamphetamine, hooked on methamphetamine, stealing from cars, breaking into occupied hotel rooms using his passkey, totally addicted to methamphetamine, breaks into Barry Van Treese's room, and as he said to Bemone Cook, things got out of control, and they sure did. And the aftermath looked exactly like that. And then he gets in front of Bemo and Cook, and Dr. Leo says, "This is what happens to somebody who's in that situation. They make things up because the police want them to." And then we know, all the way after the second trial, past 2004 into 2006, Justin Sneed knew he got away with it. He got away with everything. He blamed it on Richard. He's in a medium security facility for the rest of his life. On Wednesday, Richard Glossop is scheduled to be executed for a crime clearly he had nothing to do with. Some of you are going to be asking me, if I stop this news conference right now, you're going to start asking about Justin Sneed. And I'm going to tell you about Justin Sneed, because we did find her. We actually knew about her in a few days before the Dr. Phil show, when we got to know Justin Sneed a little bit. Sad situation for her all the way around. She had a tough life, a tough, difficult life. And she said, "I'm going to stand by my dad. Well, no matter what he says, I'm going to stand by him. I'm not going to go ahead and I'm not going to say anything more." And that's how she wants to leave it. She says, "I'm just going to stand by my dad." But you'll get in your packets an affidavit from a woman named Crystal Martinez, who was talking to Justin Sneed at the period of time that Justin Sneed was writing that email about her father wanting to recant. And that email pretty clearly sets forth that and I'll let you all read it yourself, pretty clearly sets forth the fact that Justine did say her father was going to recant. But now, things have changed, and she said, I just want to stand with my dad. It's a tough time, I want to stand with my dad. I brought up briefly in the closing argument, the prosecution mentioned how long it took for Barry Van Treese to die. Of course, Justin Snead already told us in his testimony that he sat and watched Barry Van Treese die. But the prosecution called Dr. Choi to testify differently to that, and she stretched it out for a long period of time. And thanks to Bill Cross's good reporting, a couple of jurors have said, we're bothered by that. We're bothered by the fact that we were bothered at the time of trial, by the fact that maybe Barry was alive in the room when Richard Glossop was helping Justin put the plexiglass on the window. So we wanted to clear that point up too. So we went out and we found some experts to take a look at the documents. Inside the package of documents you're going to see from the Wegrin Forensic Group in Seattle, Washington, reviewed it. It's a long report. I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but the bottom line was, he said, Mr. Snead is clear that when I stopped hitting him, it didn't really take that long for him to quit breathing. This witness account of a short period of life following the assault is consistent with the autopsy findings. The autopsy findings do not support the conclusion that the victim was alive for hours after injury infliction. You'll see a couple more opinions on Dr. Choi and her work in the packet that we send you from other respected forensic medical examiners. So we're asking today, after we're done here, we'll be going to the governor's office. We're asking the governor to grant a 60-day stay. We need more time. Like I said, every day things come up. Over the weekend, we had three investigators out working, talking to people, continuing to find new information. I continue to get emails, so many emails, that I can't even keep up with my emails from people who want to help, who have information to give. We believe there's evidence out there to further support this idea that, Richard Barrett, to further support his testimony, because we believe there was methamphetamine paraphernalia taken from his room. We don't know. We haven't seen that. There are inmates that we would love to talk to inside Joseph Hart, if they would talk to us. The problem with that, though, and I want to just raise that just briefly, a lot of people think Justin Snead, he doesn't want to come forward because he's afraid they might give him the death penalty again. I've done a lot of prison work for a lot of years with a lot of inmates, and I can tell you when I heard that, it just didn't seem to ring true to me. A lot of inmates who have a life sentence would say, give me a chance to roll those dice. I'll take my chance. If I get a death sentence, that's fine. But maybe I've got a sniff, a chance to get out. So I'll take it. What's really happening here is the place that Justin Snead is at is a medium security facility. It's a great place for him. He's got the rest of his life to do. He's justifiably afraid, as is every inmate there who could help us, justifiably afraid that if you rock the boat, they send you away. And they send you away to a maximum security facility, some place where your life could be in danger, where it's much more difficult to do your time. Being in prison is a very difficult thing. You have no control over your life at all. These people could move you for any reason whatsoever, and these people are afraid of that. Justin Snead, I would say, is very afraid that if he comes forward now, he's going to lose his place at Joseph Hart Correctional Center. We still have other witnesses. If we had 60 more days to find, it's been very difficult to find them, but we would continue to work to try to do so. Would it be enough time? I don't think so. I mean, you're asking this group of lawyers who have given their time anyway, and the investigators, to go on ahead and continue to do this. We've been at it for 120 days, and we had another 60, be 120 days or so. Wouldn't be enough time. This is a year and a half investigation, especially with people who are so far gone. Many people have died. We've got a list of witnesses who are already passed away. So hard to find other people. I began by talking a little bit about that letter that Christy Shepherd gave. And I think I'd like to end there as well. Because it's a powerful letter. It's a very powerful letter. She says, "My cousin was Debbie Carter, who in 1982 was raped and murdered. 5 years later, Dennis Fritz and Ron Williamson were convicted of the crime. Williamson received the death penalty. He had every reason to believe in the convictions. Over the years, we suffered through numerous appeals and repeated findings of guilt. Then my family was delivered a bombshell of information. DNA testing proved that Williamson and Fritz had been wrongfully convicted. We were shocked. Debbie's justice was being ripped away. We eventually learned that Debbie's case was plagued with unreliable evidence. So what does wrongful conviction feel like from the perspective of the victim or the victim's family? At first, it looks like disbelief and justice denied. We later felt a burden of guilt and shame for being led to support the near execution of innocent men. I know very little about Glossop's case or if he is truly guilty or innocent. Governor Mary Fallon stated Glossop, quote, had over 6,000 days to present new evidence. And her spokesman said, to say that Glossop has had his day in court is an understatement. In Debbie's case, too, years of trials, retrials, and appeals had happened, but the guilty verdict was still proven incorrect. Looking at the evidence, there's no doubt Glossop might be innocent, but it's almost impossible to totally prove. Van Treese and his family deserve justice, but justice won't be served if Glossop is put to death and we find out too late that he is innocent for his crime. Regardless of how you feel about the death penalty, unless we're absolutely sure of Glossop's guilt, it actually threatens justice and peace of mind to make the leap to execute him. We can't be cavalier when it comes to the subject of putting someone to death and turn a blind eye to information that may make a difference. We're asking for that 60 days. We're asking the governor to please grant us that 60 days. Give us more time. After this is over, we will be going to the governor's office where we will make that formal request from her. Let me see if Barry Scheck made it through the whole call. Barry, you still there? All right, I'm going to see if you can go ahead and kind of speak for us, and I'll put you up to the microphone, and we'll see if it works.
Okay.
Go ahead, Barry. Yes.
Can you speak on?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, I have very little to add to the very comprehensive review of the new evidence that Don, not exactly Morgan and his whole team have put together, but it is impressive. The letter that former Senator Tom Coburn, Barry Switzer, John Raley, and Sam Groves and I wrote to Governor Fallon really is trying to underscore that in unfortunate ways this case is not atypical. In our system, it does so happen that the lawyers that perhaps are best qualified to take on these cases often get involved at the end and not at the beginning. And as public attention begins to focus on a case like this, witnesses begin to emerge, expert testimony. is great. We know that at least two people, I believe Cameron Todd Willingham, who we can't do in Texas. In the modern era, we've assembled very persuasive evidence that these were innocent men that were executed in the state of Texas. Cindy Shepherd is the relative of the victim in the case of Ron Williamson and Dennis Fruit. Ron was our client at the Innocence Project, and fortunately, we were able to get DNA evidence to prove that Ron and Dennis were innocent of the crime, and that Glenn Gore, the person who actually testified against the two of them, really committed the crime, went on and committed others afterwards, and that the risk of executing innocent people, we have really been able to quantify persuasively, and that's why Sam Gross is one of the signatories to this letter. He wrote a very persuasive article in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences showing that in capital cases, we have an exoneration error rate of at least 4.1%. And that's pretty striking when you consider cases of this nature. And looking at the Glossop case, we can see that many of the risk factors that we know are in play in the conviction and death sentences of innocent people are present in this case. One always has to be concerned when the principal evidence against the defendant comes from a person that actually was involved in the criminal transaction and has an extraordinary motive to pin it on Glossop and burn and save his own life. We know that there's forensic problems in this case because if you look at the report of Dr. Weigrin, it's very persuasive that Mr. Montrez was not alive for hours after the assault by Sneed with the baseball bat. Any, I think, reasonable and fair reading of the autopsy finding is that he probably could not have been alive for more than 30 minutes following the infliction of this injury. Given lack of blood in the nose and the mouth, no fraud, airways were clear of aspirated blood, there was no swallowed blood in the stomach, all the kinds of things one would expect if he had been alive for, hours after the assault. So that is very problematical testimony that was given to the jury, and we now know from discussions with some of these jurors made a difference. And of course, everything that Don said about the different versions of events that Mr. Steve gave in one clause. So serious, respected figures in the state of Oklahoma, Senator Coburn, John Raley Jr., former United States attorney who served under both Republican and Democratic administrations, and of course, Barry Switzer, have all joined in this letter. It's a very, very simple ask of Governor Fallon, and that is, please stay this execution to permit additional investigation, which has already borne fruit. And frankly, right now, one would hope that Governor Fallon would be saying to the parole board, listen, even what they've come up with so far, it raises serious doubts. Sometimes people use the phrase residual doubts, but raises serious doubts. And you simply, on this kind of evidence, would not want to execute somebody as opposed to giving the kind of clemency that is a life without parole sentence that the clemency system is designed to do. I mean, the United States Supreme Court justices that support the death penalty, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, have noted in their opinions that they are depending upon the clemency system to be a safety valve because we all understand that this system is riddled with are suggesting to her in the letter that we have put forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. Helen, do you want to say anything at this point?
Closing remark.
Okay. So hold on a second, Barry. Helen's going to make a closing remark, and then we'll open it up if anybody has any questions, okay?
My remarks are to the citizens of Oklahoma. We have a constitution, and we believe in what our constitution gives us, and we can expect from our courts that justice will be done when trials go to court. We expect the prosecution will do their job honorably, and we expect that there will be defense on the side of people who are accused of crimes, especially if their life is at stake. From all that I have seen and understood of this case and continuing to understand, it is the citizens of Oklahoma who most of all have been failed. It's been a failed enterprise for the citizens who expect fairness, expect justice. And here we have assembled a group of lawyers pro bono who are not getting paid anything or doing the investigation that was never done for Richard Glossop. The citizens of Oklahoma do not deserve this. And the governor of Oklahoma, Governor Fallon, said the proper route is to go to the courts. You got new evidence, go to the courts. And that's what we're doing. We're getting all the new evidence we can, and every bit of the evidence that we have gotten so far is exculpatory for Richard Glossop. There's not one thing we found that points in the other direction. So it's a call for fairness, and it's a call for justice. And I also want to say to the citizens who are on the jury, they could only go with what information they learned at trial. So if Justin Snead was lying to them, they have to have a defense who could do a cross-examination, who had done due diligence to show all those versions and to catch Mr. Snead in all of his lies, so the jury could know that he's not worth believing, he's not credible, and they didn't do that. And I don't blame the jury. I feel sorry for citizens that are asked to serve on these juries and to vote life and death. But this shambles of the information they never got, and they did their best with what they had, and that's just one more signal that we have a broken system and we need to change that, and a call especially on the citizens of Oklahoma so that our court system can be honorable and fair and justice can be done. I just want to make one short announcement here that all the new documents that Don Knight talked about will be available on the Oklahoma OKCADP.org, and they will be downloaded there and you can access them there. Thank you. Don?
You got to leave Barry up here.
Well, you're back.
That's Barry. Don't forget about Barry. So, does anybody have any questions at this point? I'm sorry? Well, we're actually hoping that Governor Fallon will grant the 60-day stay. We're going to ask her to grant that 60-day stay essentially right now.
I mean,
we think we're going to get more. The way it's been going, I mean, the information that I have talked to you about has only come to light in the last couple of weeks. And so the more that gets out there, the more information we get. We don't want to go to court and say, oh, well, wait a minute, now we have some new stuff. Now we have some new stuff again, and keep going back. So we want to get to court when the time comes, but it isn't here yet. We have more work to do.
If the governor says no.
I'm sorry?
If the governor says no, do you think we'll go to court?
Well, he's going to be executed on Wednesday. We have to do something, don't we? No, we have something to give to deliver to her. We feel that she'll take it very seriously. She seems like a serious woman, so I think she knows what's happening.
Don, what court will you
No, I think we'll be filing something if we have to in the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals.
Now, what I just found out, by the way, is the same issue as saying right away, right?
You're asking me why don't we do that right away?
Yeah.
I just said because we feel we can get more new evidence. There's more to do. And when we have everything that we possibly can get, our case in the court will be that much stronger. You have to understand, it's an extremely high bar for us to meet in the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals. We think this is it. I mean, like I said, I've become fairly convinced that the version that I've told you about, you don't have to go and create some kind of grand conspiracy. This is just a drug addict, killing somebody. It happens all the time, sadly, in this country, and that's what happened here. And he saw a way to get out of this thing, and he used it. But, you know, it's really hard. It's not a DNA thing that's going to pop up like Barry was able to do in the case he was talking to you about. You know, we're looking for more witnesses. Like I said, people come out of the woodwork all the time. It's 1:30 in the morning and I get a phone call. So it'll continue to happen. I'm sorry? The criminal court can grant it or refuse to hear it on the same day. Was that your question? I imagine the criminal court of criminal appeals can do anything that they want. That's right. Well, I do believe everybody knows how quickly things are moving right now, and so yes, I think, you know, because we have to have time to do something after that, and so, you know, we'll see what happens.
Have you made any appointments to sit down and present all new evidence with either district attorneys or anybody who would be filing against you, or the governor's office to say this is why we believe what we believe and why do we believe it?
Well, that's, we hope, I mean, if the governor wishes to meet with us, we're certainly going to meet with the governor. We'll be happy to do so.
Have you made an appointment or are you going to go over there?
No, we're just going to go over there and give it to her, yeah. No other questions? Any questions for Helen or Barry Scheck? Thank you so much for coming. Thanks, Barry.